welcome back to It's an Inside Job podcast. I'm your host, Jason Lim. Now, this podcast is dedicated to helping you to help yourself and others to become more mentally and emotionally resilient so you can be better at bouncing back from life's inevitable setbacks. Now, on It's an Inside Job, we decode the science and stories of resilience into practical advice, skills, and strategies that you can use to impact your life and those around you. Now, with that said, let's slip into the stream. Well, welcome back to a fresh new episode. This week, I have another interview lined up for you guys with a gentleman named Mark Hennig, a fellow Canadian. I have just finished the audiobook, So-Called Normal. You can find it also, of course, in written format, but I like doing my runs and I like listening to audiobooks. And Mark's book really hit home to me. I got lost in my runs listening to his writings. And before I jump into the interview, I just want to give you a little bit of prime you a little bit what the book is about. Now, at 12 years old, Mark knew he had mental health issues such as anxiety, depression, insomnia, and suicidal thoughts. At 15, he tried to kill himself. Now, he had a wildly popular 2013 TEDx talk where the opening scene was about his book. Now, he stands on the edge of an overpass with the onlookers encouraging him to jump. In So-Called Normal, Hennig details intimate moments from his childhood living with an abusive and unstable family in a small town in Nova Scotia, which is the east coast of Canada, the Maritimes. Now, growing up in Sydney on Cape Breton Island, Mark suffered from pressure to conform to what is called normal in the small town ideology. In his book, he writes, quote, "Even small towns have their own internal divisions in order. We are slotted into neat little compartments, and that kept things normal. Small town culture is a fragile balance, fiercely guarded." Now, Mark fought with his inner demons, but the turmoil of his home life prevented him from receiving help. His father was an adulterer, his stepfather was emotionally neglectful, and his mother was ailing from undiagnosed seizures. In So-Called Normal, it is split into four sections. There's a summer, fall, winter, and spring. Structuring his life story by the way of the seasons builds the narrative tension as Mark recounts his growth and childhood innocence into adult experience. It is a memoir. It maps the key moments in Mark's maturation until, as a father, husband, and mental health advocate, he's able to reflect on the prior uncertainty and bring the book to a heartfelt and hopeful ending. Now, I really hope you enjoy this interview because it's deep and it's hard-hitting. It's a sobering conversation, but if you know someone who is also suffering with similar ailments, and it's easy for many of us to slip into those ailments, well, this is a rope. This is a conversation that can pull someone back from the abyss. Well, let's welcome Mark Hennig to the show. Well, a big thank you to you, Mark, for coming on It's an Inside Job. I appreciate you spending some time with us today.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Perhaps we can begin by you telling us a little about yourself, Mark.
Sure. Well, I mean, I'm a mental health advocate and activist. I've been doing this virtually all of my professional life, and I grounded in my own personal experience, my struggles with severe and persistent mental illness throughout my childhood and adolescence, repeated suicide attempts that brought me in and out of hospital more than half a dozen times, and really ever since then trying to build a life to both untangle that trauma from an early age, but also to do something good with it, to make meaningful policy impacts, to help other people at the individual level. So that's what I do now, primarily through my media work, raising awareness, helping companies and large audiences to better understand mental health.
Yeah, because I actually got the audio book, and so it was strange. I usually go for like 6 to 10 kilometer runs, and when I put yours on, and I got so lost in the story, at least the opening chapters, that my wife was wondering where I was, because when I got home, I had double hadn't run. So I have to say it just pulled me in. And I don't say this lightly. It's not a compliment, but an observation. And I found it a very sobering listen. And it really struck deep. And the reason I really wanted you on because our friend, just to give a shout out to Jim Gifford, who put us into contact, coming out of this pandemic, you know, I'm based in Norway and things are the same in Toronto and Canada and the States or what have you. And what we know is that the numbers of anxiety, depression, suicide, self-harming, what drug use, alcohol use have gone through the roof. And I think your story is something that sometimes when we talk about suicide or we talk about mental health, it's not always tabled. It's kind of, if it's a physical injury, then we can table and talk about it. But when it's mental, a lot of the times you hear, oh, just get over it. It's just a head game. But it's so much more than that. One of the lines that struck me is if you, something you wrote, I'm just paraphrasing here. If you talk about suicide, that'll give people the idea to do it as a falsehood. I was wondering if we could maybe start there.
Sure. Well, I mean, there's this persistent false idea that discussing suicide, merely discussing suicide in any form, gives people the idea to do it as though they had never thought of it before, as though when I was suicidal, somebody had mentioned to me earlier that day, have you thought of killing yourself? And I thought, no, why don't I go do that? That's not how suicide works. It grows often very organically from pain, from trauma, from a need to escape. In my case, there is a certain, I think, addictive quality to the escapism of suicide, of being unable to regulate, to manage my emotions. But what we know now from significant research, many years of research, is that talking about suicide is one of the most effective ways to prevent it. That people are probably having these ideas anyway. And yes, you might pull off all sorts of protective mechanisms that they've built on top of that to try to manage those difficult emotions. But the suicidality is still there anyway. And in fact, we need to know if it's there because we can treat it. We can help you to try to find better ways of managing those emotions. Now, I will qualify that and say that there are helpful ways and not so helpful ways of talking about suicide. We know that when you glorify it, when we over justify it as, yeah, that's understandable. Of course, you want to kill yourself. That seems like a reasonable thing to do. It's not. It's actually a cognitive distortion. It's your mind lying to you. It's not a solution to your problems. So when we frame it that way, that's not a helpful way. And in fact, we know from research in media that it can potentially contribute to suicide contagions. But when we talk constructively, when we talk about hope, when we talk about resilience and recovery, the fact that we know that we can help you deal with many of the problems that you think that suicide will help you escape from, that's a more constructive and a more helpful way to do it. But merely talking about suicide on its own, it doesn't give people the idea that that's a lie.
And as you said, there's a right way of talking about it, and there's a, maybe wrong is not the right word to say, but there's a good way of doing it and a bad way. And having the constructive, talking about hope, moving forward, actions they can do, talking about resilience is where the conversation can start. And if we could just sort of rewind back, you were originally from Cape Breton, and your book opens about your childhood and things, as you said, it wasn't a light switch that you just... It was an accumulation, small things that built up over time. But I was wondering if you could just maybe fill us in a little on the details of your background.
Sure. Well, I mean, you mentioned listening to the book and getting lost in the story. And thank you for that. I think that's one of the greatest compliments for a writer. Because as I was going back through my story to fill in the gaps, to try to figure out, you know, millions of people saw this TED talk that I did a few years earlier, where I talk about this story on the bridge, which I'll come back to. But nobody really knew all the steps that it took to get to that place and all the steps that happened after to get to the TED stage and to get to writing a book and all that stuff. So I wanted to fill in those gaps with the book. But I also wanted to make sure that it was a good book, that it was readable, that it was a good story, that it made sense. That was for two reasons. One, I wanted people to stay with me. It was partly for the audience, but to be honest, that was only about 10% of it. The rest of it, when I went away to write the book, I went away to a Trappist monastery in the woods because I'm eccentric and I needed that kind of isolation to dig into myself in that way. But self-therapeutically, I needed to make my own story make sense. I needed to piece it together to fill in those gaps, to understand myself. So what I came to through that process was being able to, I pulled all my medical records, all my school records. I went back and literally day by day tried to figure out what had happened through my childhood that led me to climb over the railing of a bridge and be absolutely convinced that I needed to die. And really, you know, the short notes version of it is that after my father left when I was 4 years old, we struggled, we were poor. We didn't really talk about mental health or emotions or anything like that. I mean, it just wasn't normal. That's partly why the book is called So-Called Normal.
So growing up in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, you know, it's not a place where people normally talk about mental health or mental illness. And that was kind of the baseline, was that it just wasn't normal. But when I moved in with the man who we came to know as my stepfather, although he and my mother were never married, I was introduced to a very different kind of home culture. One in which I was surrounded persistently by this idea that it wasn't okay to cry, that boys don't cry, to be a man, to suck it up, to hide your emotions in many ways. He was also a man who had suffered a severe brain injury to his frontal lobe due to a workplace accident. He had worked in construction. So as a result of that, although I didn't know this at the time, I only learned this through writing the book, that the extent and localization of his brain damage very well could have explained, I don't know if it did, but it could have explained his often dramatic changes in mood, his personality, his anger, impulsivity, all sorts of things that we experienced. So the result of that, you know, my older brother and sister left when we were very young. It was just my mother and I. She started trying to leave and always took me with her because I was only a little kid. And we were in and out of the house so much that I never felt like I really had any kind of secure base to grow from. And kids need that. They need to have stability and security so they can trust their foundation so they can grow into something, something else. So without any of that, I think that's really what led me to, my deep seated desire to escape a life that I thought that I was going to be condemned to forever. Over the course of the next several years, I attempted suicide many times, in increasingly dangerous attempts, more articulated attempts each time, until eventually when I late one night got to this bridge and I felt like having been in and out of hospital so many times, having talked to so many mental health professionals, doctors, I thought that I was just unhelpable. One of those unlucky few whose brain was broken and would never get better. And I didn't want to be that way anymore. So I climbed over that railing late at night on a Sunday night. And that's when I was interrupted by a stranger, a complete stranger who happened to see me, who talked to me. And eventually, when I let go of the railing, who reached out, grabbed me and saved my life. That for me was, you know, not only a life-saving moment, literally, but from that moment on, I only through writing the book realized that symbolically, it planted a seed in me that I could be like that stranger who reached out and saved my life. So I think that's what that's the life that I've been trying to model and elaborate ever since, was to be like this guy who creates space for people to be safe and hopefully saves their lives.
And I think that, you know, because I used to work with trauma, my background's in clinical cognitive sciences. And so when I've talked to a lot of people over the years, there's a sense of isolation that this is only happening to me. I'm the only one. I think that's why to some extent, group therapy sometimes helps normalize this, that we can have these what may seem like abnormal emotions, but are actually normal emotions to an abnormal situation. And that when people feel this isolation, and that arm or that voice that reached out to you on that dark Sunday night on this very, I guess it's not traversed this bridge so often, reached out to you, and it was a turning point. And I think this conversation, Mark, you know, something about the podcast, it will go directly into someone's ears. It has an intimate way directly into someone's brain. And the words that you share, and I think it's so significant because it can have an impact on someone who's teetering on the abyss. And I think that is sometimes what we need, is someone who can help us. In the book, and actually in a following interview, you talked about this particular individual. What was it that he said that resonated with you, that struck deeper than most of the therapy and the help that you've had through the years?
You know, interestingly, it wasn't so much what he said, but what he didn't say. You know, I had talked to so many so-called experts for so long that they all seemed to talk the same way. They all ran the same assessments. They all went down the same forms. I looked at most of them when I pulled my medical records. And that's what I noticed, was that he didn't ask me about my medications. He didn't ask me about my different reactions. And I'd been on a dozen or more medications by that point, in all sorts of different cocktails and combinations. I had all sorts of adverse reactions to them. He didn't ask me about my therapies. I hadn't really actually done a lot of therapy. I didn't realize that until later either. I had two kind of stints, a couple of weeks long each, of some very basic cognitive behavioral therapy. But it was basic as in, you know, recognizing your thoughts. It wasn't really getting into practicing much of anything. But it did help, you know, while I was doing it.
Yes.
He didn't ask me about my symptoms. He didn't say anything like, you're crazy for doing what you're doing, or you're stupid, or you're selfish. You know, this is all the narratives, I think, that were partly in my head, but also that people do really say. What he did do was to leave a lot of, he left a lot of silence. He left a lot of space, uncomfortable space, I'm sure. He didn't rush to fill it in or to solve my problems. And most importantly, he asked me about what I was interested in. He asked me things that I was, excuse me. He asked me things that I was passionate about, that I liked, that I was good at. He asked me, I think, about my cat, my pets. You know, he asked me about my friends and my family. And this might seem fluffy, but that was exactly what I needed. I needed somebody to actually see me as I saw myself, and I saw myself wasn't necessarily all just symptoms. I felt like left space for the whole me. And that's really, I think, what I aspire to do as well.
I think all those are super salient points, because, you know, rumination is, it makes its home in the depressed mind and the anxiety filled mind. And rumination, if it's not controlled, it spins out. And sometimes it's hard to use the brain to get out of the brain. He didn't see you as something broken. He didn't see you as a problem that needed fixed. I've been there myself, where I became so desensitized that I actually had to get out of that game. Compassion fatigue maybe is the best way I can articulate it. What I hear this gentleman had helped you, he focused on the things that you could control, where you had certainty, where your interests were. It completely shifted your focus. And I think it comes back to what you're saying about having those constructive dialogues when it comes to suicide. There are certain ways of doing this constructively that any of us can learn, simple techniques. You don't have to have a PhD or a doctorate to do this, but I guess it's almost that human connection you heard. I think that is that sliding door, that moment that pulled you back from the abyss. I understand why you do what you do, is to help more of those people to come back from the edge. In the second part of our conversation, Mark talks about the process that he went through writing the book, how it was a journey that was very cathartic and very healing. It allowed him to bring up things that he had forgotten, those kinks, those knots, and allowed him to work through them. And so those memories and those emotions that were troubling, well, once he had worked them out, they went back into his memory differently, where he became the master of his story. Mark also talked about the importance of expanding our emotional vocabulary in order to process our emotions. We also discussed a host of other cognitive tools, such as compartmentalization, being a bystander, being able to walk into the storm of an experience so it can temper our expectations. As Mark says, resilience is about being comfortable in the discomfort. Just explore the book for a second. When you were writing the book, it almost sounded like it was a form of journaling or expressive writing, but of course, in a trying to relate to someone else for readers to do it. Did you find it a very cathartic process as you were writing it? Did it bring up memories or reflections that you hadn't had before?
Absolutely. And, you know, it needed to, because I wanted to, part of the reason for going away to the monastery the first time, and then every other time after that, I went away many times, actually, was that I needed to get to the real truth that even I hadn't yet uncovered. Because when you have these kinds of experiences, just to cope, you cover it up with a lot of layers of coping and denial and justifications. And so when I did a lot of the outlining first, I did a lot of the research, I brought it all along with me, and then just dug into it day by day and really needed to reprocess. And I found things happening, you know, with my memory, the pulling things out. Your memory is like a barrel of monkeys, that kid's toy that you pull one out, yeah, and then another comes, and then that brings another with it, and you just got a whole string of memories. So stuff started to come out that I didn't even realize that I had remembered. And that, interestingly, I still think about this all the time. After I went away, after that first draft, and then all the other draft, we went through 14 drafts or something. But after it was all done, it was like I had pulled all that stuff out of me, worked on it on the outside, put it back in. But when I put it back in, it was different. And then actually, I found myself struggling to remember some parts of it later on, because it was like it was all my life had just been beneath my skin, just always there. All that trauma, all that stuff, it was always there and accessible to me. But then after I pulled it out and worked on it and put it away, put it back away in its little closet where it belonged inside me, I didn't need it anymore. So I could let it just fade into the background. So that was one of, I think, the most cathartic and healing aspects of doing the book, was the ability to really process those memories.
And I think that word process, I think processing emotions. So there's two things I just like to address there, because I think processing emotions is something that is so needed, because it gets trapped in the central nervous system and it can come out in different ways. It can come out in skin rashes, losing your hair. It can come out in ruminations and thoughts. It has so many different permutations. But one thing I found interesting, what you said, is when I wrote 14 drafts and then it went back differently, you know, understanding neuroscience, that's almost that memory reconsolidation. So you can call back up a birthday when you were 12 years old as a 35-year-old. And when you recall it, it will never go back. It will be reconsolidated because it will be influenced by the man you are today, or the woman you are today, depending on, you know, who it is, and the values you stand for and where you are in life and the perspective. So I just found, I like to talk to authors about that, because I think the process of writing is so cathartic and it's so liberating. And I think if a lot of people are struggling with emotions, sometimes it's just, there's no rules. Just write for 20 minutes and then write for another 20 minutes. Just get it out. And this is one of the best ways to processing. Others is to have talk therapy or to talk to someone. I was wondering if we could just reflect on, you said processing memories and processing emotions. Many of us find it very hard to articulate emotions above, beyond, I'm happy or I'm angry or I'm sad. Mm-hmm. And I think being able to articulate and then specifically identify emotions really helps in the healing process or dealing with difficult thoughts and memories. From your experience, how can someone be better at the vocabulary of emotions so they can process emotions?
Yeah, this is a good question. It's something that I've been thinking a lot about lately, that, so many of us, and surveys have indicated this, move through our world with basically three emotions, happy, sad, and angry, without a whole yeah. lot of other color to them, right? And Brené Brown recently just talked about this, and others do as well. Lori Gottlieb has, Susan David certainly, a number of others. Lisa Feldman Barrett is great on this. But developing the kind of emotional granularity that allows you to separate out those three categories, or as Carrie Fisher used to say, she used to hate when people hurt both of her emotions, that when you actually start to parse them out, it does this thing, I think, in your brain and certainly in your mind, where it gives you more buckets to compartmentalize your different experiences. If you only have two buckets, happy and sad, the stimuli come in, the information comes in, the memories, the experiences, the conversations with other people, the thoughts, whatever they are, And then basically it has two choices. Is this going to make you happy or sad? And then it turns out that those choices are often based on your past experience. If you're usually sad, if you have a cognitive bias to see the world in a sad way, then that otherwise ambiguous information, if you only have two buckets, is probably going to go into the sad bucket because that's the one that you use the most. It's the most accessible.
Well said.
But if you have more buckets, then you have more options. Well, okay, maybe it's sad, but is it grief? Is it just kind of ennui? Is it uncomfortable? Is it curious? You know, is it unfamiliar? You have all these different options. And then it turns out when you have different categories for that emotion, there's different strategies you can use. Maybe it's not so bad, or maybe there are ways. Maybe I actually do have ways to deal with this. So it gives you a whole robust toolkit when you're able to actually give more words, give more mental categories to your experiences. It gives you more options. And I think you can not just bifurcate, you can find many different ways to separate out your emotions, to give more granularity, more texture, more nuance, until it eventually becomes like a wine tasting, where you start to notice all the different notes and undertones and the palate and the mouth feel.
Yeah.
Exactly, of all your emotions. And that's when it gets really cool and interesting, actually. And I think that's partly what underpins my really intense interest in art and in performance art and creativity, because that's really where you start to tap into that emotional granularity, I think. So that's the importance of it. It helps you to really see the world in a multicolored way.
I think that's a very salient point, because we don't always have to describe emotions with particular verbs, or as verbs, with words, I meant to say. Sometimes we can do it through the expression of art. Because I remember I have twin girls, and when they were very young, when they were 3, 4, and they'd come home from kindergarten, daycare, and they were upset, they didn't have the vocabulary to articulate what they were feeling. So I'd say, hey, Katya, Erica, have a seat at the thing. Here's a piece of paper. And I gave them a bunch of crayons. And I would say, can you draw what happened today for daddy? And they would go. And I could see that they were upset or crying. But as they did it, I could see they were processing the emotions, because they'd slowed down. They put a little more detail. And then that would stabilize them. And then what I would say, Mark, is say, hey, Katya, Erica, can you tell daddy, can you describe the picture to me? And they would describe the picture. But for me, it was a way for them to articulate and to describe and to deal with their emotions, and not to bury them, but to process them. And as you said, it could be sculpting, it could be painting, it could be poetry, what have you. And I think that's so important in schools today, especially after, as we move into a post-pandemic, that don't cut the arts and crafts program, because the arts and crafts program may be the vehicle in which these children, students, university, what have you, can process their emotions and deal with that, so it doesn't bottled up. Does this resonate with yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I mean, we don't, I think there's this understandable discomfort with dealing with discomfort, we want to be happy, we want to feel good. Those are all noble aims, and we want to avoid aversive things. We want to avoid pain, avoid sadness. Unfortunately, we know that when you do that, when you only focus on happy and avoid all of the other stuff, it's a toxic positivity that actually doesn't help you be happy. That ironically, it's almost like a Zen koan or a Buddhist kind of understanding of it, that if you want to be happy, you have to embrace your unhappiness. You have to understand and accept and hold that discomfort. Because when you learn to do that, when you learn to make space for the difficulty, it allows you to let it go, to not cling to it. We spend so much of our time fighting with our negative experiences that's what keeps them a part of us. That's what clings, is the fight. Let it go. Experience it. Let it float in. Watch it. And, you know, when I after the bridge and I started to recover, I didn't know that at the time because I had so many relapses over the years.
Yeah.
I used to be really hard on myself for my relapses. Oh, I can't believe that this is here again. I thought I got through this. You know, I can't do this anymore. And eventually something clicked where I was able to slowly, when the depression would come, I'd recognize the signs. I would know the time of year that I would usually relapse. I would know how to see the changes in my body and mind. And much later would get to a place where I would be able to say, wow, look at that depression. There it is again. Oh, that's a good one. Look at that one. But I would know this is going to suck. This is going to be hard. This hurricane is going to be awful, but it's going to pass because it's passed 100 times before. So what's so different about it this time? Sometimes you just have to let it hurt.
I think, you know, experience, she or he is a good teacher. It is a good teacher. It allows us to temper our expectations of how things are. But sometimes we need to, as you said, move into the storm to experience, because in my perception of things, I don't think there's negative or positive emotions. I see it as either comfortable or uncomfortable emotions, but all emotions serve some level of purpose, because for me, emotions are just a chemical recipe of neuromodulators, hormones, neurotransmitters, and depending on how they're tweaked, that might be the sense of adventure, or the sense of excitement, or the sense of overwhelm, or the sense of drowning. Because one of the things you talked about, in order to process the emotions in the book, you said, you know, leave the past in the past, and you just mentioned a cognitive take called compartmentalization. When I used to work with people, what I found, those who were able to move on followed pretty much the same line of thinking as you, Mark, leave the past in the past. Mm-hmm. And how they did it, they made sense of it. They were no longer a victim to the thoughts. And in a sense, it comes back to that memory reconsolidation. They talked about and talked about and talked about it, where they actually changed the meaning they give to the situations. Those who got stuck in the muck, is that they couldn't accept it. They couldn't move on. And it's, for me, that was sort of the difference, the linchpin that helped people move on. I was wondering if you could speak to leaving the past in the past and compartmentalization in your words, of course.
Well, you know, it started for me in a very pathological way, actually, that because I had experienced so much early childhood trauma, that I started from a relatively young age, probably at least 8, maybe younger, to dissociate, a way of just letting my mind float away, or float in, actually. Usually that's when I can distinctly remember becoming an introvert. I think I was always sensitive. I always had a sensitive temperament, but I remember needing to turn inward in order to avoid the scary outward stuff, developing these elaborate places in my mind that were places of comfort very often. So that was part of my early attempts to compartmentalize. My mind's early attempts to compartmentalize was to dissociate. Eventually, it became problematic because I couldn't be in the present. I would get lost in the compartments, or locked in the compartments, and unable to get out. Later on, I began to learn how to use that technique therapeutically to be able to hive off some of the negative stuff, to stay in touch with it. So it had a sort of porous quality to it, to be able to get in touch with the emotion of it, but to leave it separate from me. And especially when it came to other people's stuff, when you're very sensitive, and often highly sensitive people, it seems, just an anecdotal observation, seem to have shared experiences of trauma in many ways, because you have to learn to watch other people's emotions closely in order to ensure that you're going to be safe. I find that it can be overwhelming, to experience other people's emotions. And it was very hard for me to learn how to compartmentalize their stuff, that they are not me, that they might be unhappy with something that I said or did or something that I am, but that's not my problem. That's their problem. And when that realization came to me, that was so important, because it helped me to actually open up about my own story, to share that I was struggling with my mental health, that I had been in and out of the hospital, that I had tried to kill myself. And interestingly, when I did start to open up in high school, many people, although some people had the negative reaction, that negative reaction was their problem, not mine, more people had the opposite of what I was expecting. They actually accepted me more, I felt like. I had feared that I would be rejected and cast off, to a the colony of lepers because of my illness. Mm-hmm. And it was the opposite, actually. People started to open up about all the stuff that they had kept tight inside as well. So we kind of mm-hmm. created this new society, at least in my experience, mm-hmm. of people with lived experience. So I became part of something else. So, you know, the compartmentalization thing, like anything else, in moderation, is very helpful to be able to mm-hmm. separate out your emotions and discriminate between them and find strategies for them. But gone too far, you can over-compartmentalize. When those boundaries become too rigid, it mm-hmm. separates mm-hmm. people out. So I think the goal then is to always remain flexible, to remain porous, and mm-hmm. to be able to open and close those compartments as needed.
Now, in the final part of our conversation, Mark talks about the difference between realism versus pessimism, where realism is the side he chooses to take. And it's to see emotions in a neutral form, that emotions are neither good nor bad. They're either comforting or they're discomforting, but all emotions serve a purpose to signal us about what's going on in our internal and external environments. We also talked about mindfulness, but the importance of structured mindfulness. We also talked about the importance of setting boundaries and having well-defined boundaries, because then we have a well-defined self. And we also talk about the state of self-awareness and being self-aware and how important it is in the role of building resilience.
In some ways, realism and pessimism. Realism gets a bad rap. Realism gets seen as pessimism. And they're not the same thing, I don't think. Realism is a radical neutrality to the emotional valence of the world. It's a looking at things realistically and saying, this is neither good nor bad, it just is. That's how I now understand my depression, my experiences with suicide, my difficult emotions. They just are. Emotions are just data points. Sometimes when you get on your own mental trip, you get lost on the trip and you don't realize that you're on the trip. you lose contact with the core self because you're lost in the emotion and it becomes all of you. But then you come back down to earth and you can look back and realize, wow, what a trip I was just on, whether it was a power trip or an anger trip or a sadness trip. And I think when you can ground yourself in that, in your center, in your core, you can realize that your mind is going to take all these different flights, and it doesn't necessarily have to alter your core self.
Like anything, I guess that takes training and takes discipline to build that default habit. You know, you're going through it. You might have the negative emotions, but then you can notice those emotions and not, you know, identify with those emotions. Because for me,
Well, I was just going to say, I think that's the power of structured formal mindfulness training in particular that I have really benefited from. That there's this idea that mindfulness is just for relaxation, and it's not. Mm. There's also been a proliferation of consumer mindfulness, which there's nothing wrong with. I think any entry point is a good entry point, but there's been a commercialization of it. When in reality, coming back to your breath. People sometimes get frustrated that, you know, I can't focus because my mind keeps wandering or I keep thinking about all these other things. That is mindfulness. That is the practice. Noticing that you're thinking of other things, noticing that your mind is wandering. And as Jon Kabat-Zinn, the American, at least father of mindfulness, says, you're always coming back to the breath, gently bringing yourself back. That is the practice. And why that's relevant, I think, here is because that comes back out to your emotions as well. Your emotions are going to go all over the place. You're going to experience lots of things. You're going to feel lots of things. But then you're always coming back to yourself. That's the practice. The more you do it, the better you get.
Because we know that we have the two hemispheres. We have two emotional centers and we have two rational centers. And the left amygdala, it's about feeling emotions, where the right amygdala, to a very simplistic sense, is feeling experientially. And so when you come back to your breath, you fire off a different emotional center than the others. I mean, all four centers, when they're balanced, they work together. But right. I think what's so important is what you said, it's the structured mindfulness. There are specific mm-hmm. ways to do it so you don't fall into the trap of rumination, because mindfulness itself can be a trap door to even worse rumination and overthinking. And so
I think that the dangers of mindfulness thing, it's been talked about many times before, but I think it also partly comes from a misunderstanding of what mindfulness actually is. It comes back to that idea, that misunderstanding that mindfulness is always supposed to make you feel good. No, it's not. Mindfulness is work sometimes. Meditation is work. I can't even count the number of times I've sat on my cushion and just fallen apart, just dissolved into tears, or really needed to work through hard stuff, because it's doing the work is hard, but it's necessary work. So when you're in a mindful moment, and it pulls up all this stuff, this, whether it's ruminations or negative stuff or trauma, and there is good research that it might not be safe, unguided for people, especially with psychosis and other types of conditions. But that's because that's showing you with full force all the stuff that you're avoiding. And sometimes you have, and actually often, you have to ease into it slow and build that muscle so that you can sit with that discomfort for longer. And that's the transferable skill that you're taking into your life. If you want to learn how to sit, how to be comfortable with discomfort, sit on a cushion for 2 hours and see how easily you can sit with the discomfort physically, mentally, and otherwise, because that's your training ground for the rest of your life.
And I think that's an important point, is to kind of wade into the waters. And sometimes it is to do it with a practitioner, someone who has deep experience, so they can walk you in like any other skill. You're not going to start using a chainsaw on a tree if you don't have some experience. You're going to start small, maybe, right? But there's still that danger. But it's nothing to be afraid of. But as you said, you don't go deep into the swirling ocean. You're going to start in a quiet lake or a pond or something to practice your skill, to build up that skill set. You also mentioned something about boundaries. Sometimes people have such porous boundaries that everything, it just floods them and it overwhelms them. Mm-hmm. Concretely, what advice would you give, Mark, based on your deep experience on how we can set boundaries for ourselves to protect ourselves?
Mm. Yeah, you know, everything since this is the track that we're on around dealing with discomfort, I think everything has been relating back to that. And I think boundaries does too, because when you have sort of a diffused, I think, sense of self, when you don't have a well-articulated core self that you've done some work on, there's a tendency for the boundaries of your perception to sort of be too fluid, where you lose yourself in other people, and you become codependent in relationships, and you can't really define yourself as separate from the rest. You haven't fully individuated from the rest of the world. So I think part of that could be tied up with all sorts of adolescent and early childhood attachment stuff. How able were you to explore the world? Did you have a secure base, a safe base from which you could explore the world around you? So I think as an adult, we need to, first of all, figure out what our boundaries are. So often people don't even know what they're comfortable with and what they're not. Or for some people, especially early on, your boundaries are very tight, very rigid, very perfect. Everything needs to be this way and only this way. And if it's any other way, I'm just going to fall to pieces. So we need to be able to first define what our boundaries are and then to work with them a little bit. Does it need to be so structured? Does it need to be so rigid all the time? I'm actually going to be okay if we safely go a little bit further than this boundary that I've set up. Or maybe this is a hard boundary and this can't change because this is what I'm comfortable with and this is what I'm not. And that's okay too. So I think you need to define what your boundaries actually are. And then the second step is accepting that other people have different boundaries. Not everybody's going to like your boundaries. And that comes back to what we said before. Well, that's said. Their problem, right? Your boundaries are, if other people have problems with you, that's your problem, not theirs. That's their stuff, not theirs. And that's okay. And sometimes, especially if you're highly sensitive, especially if you tend toward codependency, that's really hard to realize, oh my God, this person might not like me. This person might think ill of me. At the end of the day, so what? Let them. You don't own their mind. You don't control their mind. Let them have their mind and you will have yours. That's part of the individuation process, I think.
Yeah, and then from my experience of helping people set up boundaries, or for myself, first of all, it's to understand what's the bloody narrative that's going through my head, right? I mean, there's numbers. It could be overwork. It could be a fear of conflict, a fear of change, a fear of imposter syndrome, a fear of upsetting others, where everyone has to feel, you know, everyone else has to be happy at the sacrifice of myself, whatever the narrative is. And so sometimes I think what you said is so important, and it comes back to the writing or the speaking. It's articulating those emotions, understanding what's going on. And if I can write down those narratives, and for me, for most people, working for most people, a narrative comes down to three or four sentences or a couple of questions we keep repeatedly asking yourselves. As they say, maybe I'm aging myself here, but it's that broken record, right? But it's understanding that, because once you write down the rules or the narrative that's going through your head, you can, it has nowhere to go. In your head, it morphs, it evolves into different things. It hides away in the recesses of your mind. You write it down, yeah. You articulate abstract thoughts into concrete words. It has nowhere to go. And you can look at that and think, that's healthy, that's healthy, that's dysfunctional, that's dysfunctional, and then change it. So for my, I really, what you say really overlaps with my thinking. It's like, you need to be self-aware. But that leads me to another question. You know, one thing is doing all these techniques and getting on top of it when we are aware. But how does, because once we're lost in an emotional storm, we're so wrapped up in that emotional storm that we forget to become self-aware. We're just going on programming. What is your advice to, concrete advice to make ourselves self-aware? When I'm lost, what can I do to pull myself out so I can become that observer of my subjective storm?
Yeah. So before you have any kind of scaffolding, it can be hard to, you know, it's hard to build scaffolding in a storm when it's windy, because the wind just keeps blowing the scaffolds over and then blowing it away, and you don't even remember that there was scaffold there. So this is a good area. How do you start essentially from ground zero? And I think the way that you do that is not only at the beginning, but all throughout, is to focus on one simple thing that you can embed into the very core of your being. Not some, there's lots of books out there, lots of methods, lots of big fancy structures and acronyms. Oh my God, the acronyms that you'll encounter in the self-help and psychology everywhere. And I've made a lot of them. I've contributed to the sludge. Anyway, for me, it's finding one anchor that you can come back to. If you've seen the movie Inception, like a totem or a token that you can come back to. For me, it's my breath, to come back to my breath, so that you're in a storm, notice your breath. And then eventually, just through basic operant conditioning, you can remind yourself, when I notice my breath, it reminds me who I am. It reminds me of my core. So when your mind is floating off into whatever trip it's on, the anger trip or the guilt trip or whatever, notice your breath, and it brings you back. And the more you do it when you're well, the more you practice that one thing when you're well, the more likely you're going to remember it when you're not doing so well. That's the way things work. You can't learn coping mechanisms when you need coping mechanisms the most, because everything is like trying to build your house in the storm, right?
Yeah.
So let the storm die down. Exactly. Let the storm die down. Start to build from the ground up the most stable foundation of the most simple thing you possibly can, a rock solid center. And then you get to elaborate on that with all the fancy structures you want later on. But even experienced, I think, people well experienced in recovery, in self-care, in self-help stuff, I think they would all still come back to that one simple thing that you can do. And for me, it's just breathe.
I think you made another really salient point. It's that to practice this stuff, you can't do it in the moment when you're having a mental breakdown or you're melting down, per se. It's in when you're in a neutral state or you're having a good time. It's to identify. It comes back to those increasing your the ability to articulate different emotions. Think about it. When you're in a good place, sitting on a bus and nothing's going on, what are you feeling? What are you seeing? What are experiential? And by doing that, when you're in a good place or in a neutral place, and you do that repeatedly, well, it's about building a habit, a default habit. It's not how long you do it. It's how often you do it. So that really resonates with me. And when it comes back to your breathing, another way, or you called it a token or a totem of some sort from inception and what you do yourself. What I've always done and what I talk to sometimes I tell someone if they're going, they know they're going to have some sort of emotional storm coming up, go down to your local ravine, go down to the local brook or river, look for a little pebble, something doesn't have to be big, something that just captures your attention, stick it in your pocket. And when you know you're going to have with things, when you feel that little stone, nobody has to see it. Or if you know you're going into a meeting, you're going to have a tough meeting. Just put that little stone, because with all the other paraphernalia on the table, no one's going to really notice it. But that becomes your mental anchor. I guess it comes back to your anchor, which is your breath. Mm-hmm. I can censor myself, right?
Yeah, it's a reminder, and it can be a physical thing. It's very common to use, especially if you're a tactile kind of person. Mm. Maybe it's a necklace or a wrist or a bracelet, a ring. Mm. But it could be part of your body. Grounding exercises like rubbing the tips of your fingers or tapping, or feeling the feeling of your feet on the ground. For me, I use breath because it's always available. As long as I'm living, I have it with me, and I can be forgetful sometimes. So I'm not going to remember that stone or that thing or whatever. And I don't like stuff around my neck. For me, the breath is just always there for me, no matter what.
Well, Mark, it's the top of the hour. I'm very respectful of your time, so I really appreciate the your generosity of time. I know you've asked about this time and time again, but you've made time for me today and my audience. Just one last question. Was there any last tip or any last idea you'd like to leave my listeners with or our listeners with?
Well, I always like to remind people, especially when they're at the worst, that it really can get better, that who you are in your worst moments isn't necessarily representative of who you are in your life. It's not your identity. You are not your struggle. That's part of your story. It's an important part of your story. And in fact, you might even get to a point like I have where you need that as part of your story because, geez, it's great material. And you can get to a point where you think you encounter adversity, you encounter challenge, you encounter the most intense negative emotions, and you think, oh, this is going to make a great story. I think that's a good place to get to in your life. So use your story. It's nobody else's. All that stuff happened to you. You might as well do something with it.
And I think adversity, when we're facing adversity, our real self shows up. And if there's something we don't really like about how we're facing adversity, then that shows us the work we have to do, where we have to grow and where we have to learn to become more resilient in that sense. But Mark, thank you very much. I will include your book and all your links in the show notes. And what's the best way people can reach out to you?
So I'm on most social media platforms at Mark Hennick. That's at MarkHennick. My website, markhennick.com. And the book is So-Called Normal, A Memoir of Family Depression and Resilience. If you want to know anything more about me, it's pretty much all in there. and that's available worldwide right now, everywhere.
All right, brother. Well, thanks, Mark. I really, really appreciate your time again. And stay safe and keep going with that message because I think it's so important even now as we come in, as we migrate into a post-pandemic world.
Thanks, Jason. Take care.
Bye for now. Well, another big thank you to Mark Hennick for joining me this week. It was a sobering hour, but it was very revealing. The experiences, the knowledge, and the skills he shared. I would highly recommend anybody to pick up his book, So-Called Normal. You know, you may be or you may know someone who is living with some level of mental health issues. And it'll help you to recognize signs and patterns of depression, anxiety. And sometimes it can be difficult for people to put words to emotions that can feel indescribable. But hopefully this conversation has taken you, us, anyone a step forward. And his book, So-Called Normal, is a great manual to help us to recognize that sometimes we need to reach out for help and that mental health issues are common. They are normal. And we have all the ability to work it out. And there are resources and professionals and methodologies out there that can help us. Just remember, a bad day, a bad week, a bad month just does not mean a bad life. And that when we're in the middle of a storm, it can seem like it will last forever. But all storms do pass. We do come through those storms. And those storms, those experiences, they can help shape our expectations. But sometimes those storms can seem so daunting that we can't, or we find it hard to find the courage to walk that road alone. Well, there are many organizations, professionals, people out there who can help us through those storms, who can lend us an objective hand to walk us through to the other end. And I highly recommend you or others who are suffering under some level of mental health issue, seek out those resources because it can make all the difference. Well, a big thanks to you, dear listener, for showing up for another week. I really appreciate you signing up, liking, subscribing, and sharing this podcast with others. Well, until next week, keep well, keep strong, and we'll speak soon.